My name is Omaya Jones, and this is the Arkansas Times Week in Review podcast for Friday, March 15th, 2024. Thanks for joining us. On Friday, the Arkansas Legislative Council approved an emergency rule change that not only makes it harder to change the gender listed on the official state IDs, including driver's licenses, but also limits the options to M or F for male or female. This is a change to a previous policy in which there was also an option for X, which was put in place 14 years ago. Editor-in-Chief Austin Gelder spoke with Managing Editor Benjamin Hardy, who wrote a piece about the change in policy.
So, Benji, you had a story today about what happened at the Capitol regarding gender markers on driver's licenses. Can you tell me a little bit about what happened?
I guess we were all sort of tag-teaming the story this week. I think the news first came out on Tuesday with a press release from the State Department of Finance and Administration, which I think we don't really think of as one of the state agencies where you're getting a lot of controversial stuff. You know, Education Department, sure. DHS, sure. But, you know, Finance Administration, they handle tax revenue. They also handle the DMV, though. And so the news came that they were suddenly changing a longstanding state policy of allowing people to change the gender on their state-issued IDs or driver's licenses. And to choose the option of an X instead of an M or an F for male or female. So, you know, it was this reversal of a policy which had been sort of quietly in place for a while of saying that there is, you know, people could not choose a gender-neutral option and that the, I believe the option on their ID had to, the gender on their ID had to match the gender on their birth certificate.
Yes, so that press release came out on Tuesday. One perplexing part to me was the emergency part of it. So right. My understanding is that they wanted to pass this emergency rule, which basically rushes us through the process, gives no opportunity for public input, and it happened in a matter of 4 days. What's the emergency?
So after that, you know, after that news was announced, then the legislature has to sign off, basically. So then on Thursday and Friday, there were two legislative panels that sort of quickly gave their okay and said, yes, great, that's right, this is an emergency, let's pass it and institute the rule, the emergency rule. And there were some Democratic state legislators that asked the same thing, you know, what's the emergency here? It's been 14 years since, I mean, DFNA began doing this. Why is this suddenly a problem? I think Senator Clark Tucker said this morning at the Arkansas Legislative Council, you know, if it's an emergency, it's supposed to be, I mean, that's defined. It's like there's an issue that is presenting some sort of peril to the state, to the general public welfare. I can't remember the exact language, but basically, you know, it's not just like completely arbitrary here.
Right. I think imminent peril has to be there.
Something like that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the response from the from Jim Hudson, who's the head of DFNA these days, was that, well, law enforcement may not be able to tell, I mean, proper information about an individual that they've pulled over or something. It creates some sort of a issue for law enforcement if the sex on somebody's birth certificate doesn't match the gender ID on their state issued driver's license.
Well, so what if I dye my hair blonde? Would that create a problem?
Yeah, I mean, what if you look different in the picture, you know, than you know you look today? I don't know. I mean, it seems pretty ridiculous to think that this is creating some sort of a public safety hazard. But I mean, everybody, like the governor, gave the game away from the very beginning with the press release where she said she went out of her way to say like something like Arkansas doesn't tolerate nonsense. There are only two genders.
Women can give birth.
Yeah, right. Men can't give birth. Something about women's sports, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Right. So I think what you're getting at here is that this really actually had very little to do with the, I believe, about 560 Arkansans who have an X in the gender box on their driver's license, and everything to do with politics and messaging.
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, it is a slap in the face to transgender Arkansans and others who may not identify as male or female. It just seems so unnecessary, I think, is the thing that really stands out about this, is like it came out of the blue. Like, I don't know who was complaining about
right.
this. There were some legislators, Democratic legislators that said, like, can you give any examples of law enforcement having a problem where there's been a case where, you know, this created an issue for law enforcement? nothing came up.
So we've established that this is not an emergency, and in fact, it's not even a problem. And yet we raced it through as an emergency rule. Was that about right?
Right. And my understanding is there will be a permanent rule put in place eventually. Is that your understanding?
Yes. And that there will be an opportunity for the public to comment. So yes, there will be that, but you know, it's already going to be in place, I guess, right now.
Yeah. And I mean, Senator Tucker this morning made a motion, alternate motion to pull that piece out of the committee's sort of larger agenda, saying that the public really should have a chance to comment on this. You know, this is clearly a matter of interest to a number of people, but that failed. And so it was just kind of rubber stamped and moved through the committee. You know, we were talking yesterday a little bit about how a lot of the attacks on around transgender issues from the Sanders administration and from other Republican governors have been, like, you know, I think focused on genuine wedge issues. You know, I mean, things where I think there is a lot of public, you know, a lot of the public feels sort of has mixed feelings. Like, I think, you know, women's sports is a classic example. Treatments for youth, for kids under the age of 18. I mean, these are things that do divide public opinion, especially when you're talking about children and when you're talking about schools. This is, I feel like, kind of a different kind. You know, these are right. Adults. Like, these are,
right. So it's not, oh, we need to protect children. That this is just, you know, blatantly going after adults. There's not really any. I mean, they tried to suggest there was a public safety component, but we're unable to give any example of a 14-year history. So it does seem more aggressive and without merit.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it is the aggressiveness that really strikes me, and the fact that, you know, this has been the status quo for so long without, I mean, any apparent complaints.
Right. And it came up this week because in Kansas, a judge there made a decision that requiring driver's license to have only M or F with no other option did not violate that state's constitution. That came down Monday. And I think that what happened was someone saw it and it was a great opportunity for us to kick some transgender people around, too.
So it seems. Okay. Thank you.
You can read more about this by going to arctimes.com. For the March edition of the Arkansas Times, Matt Campbell wrote a piece about the ongoing conflict between the governor's office, the attorney general's office, and the Arkansas Board of Corrections. Some of the turmoil we've covered before on this podcast, but Matt took a deeper look into the origins of the conflict, which had to do with very real issues in the prison system, including overcrowding, an inability to fully staff the prison workforce, and how the problems were expected to be exacerbated by something called the PROTECT Act. Benjamin Hardy spoke with Matt Campbell about this story, which you can read now online or in the print edition currently on newsstands.
I think this all goes back to, you know, a lot of it goes back to the PROTECT Act.
Right.
And these changes that were made last spring, about a year ago, big package of criminal justice and corrections reform legislation. And I mean, it was a big deal at the time, but I feel like it got a little bit overshadowed by some other things, like especially Arkansas Learns, the big education bill. Yeah. But as you know, one of the things you talk about in your story is, like, it's really on par with Learns as far as kind of the sweeping changes that it's making to the correction system. All this kind of goes back to the governor's stated desire to lock people up in prison for longer. So what exactly is the PROTECT Act, and what does it do?
Well, like you said, it's sweeping. The comparison to the Learns Act works pretty well just in terms of, like, They're roughly the same length, you know, page-wise. Uh-huh. They're both hurried through in a very abbreviated fashion, but without much time for any kind of public input or comment. And they're both sort of these omnibus packages that touch on so many different aspects of state government and funding and who's in charge of what, and uh-huh. shuffle people around, all with this sort of underlying goal of the governor's of locking more people up longer. And really, the PROTECT Act does that. The two main ways are, one, increasing how long people need to be in prison before they're eligible for parole. Mm-hmm. And then for some of the more violent crimes, some sex crimes, some child-related crimes, removing the potential for parole at all.
Got it.
And the idea seems to go back to that whole, you know, quote, catch and release thing that the governor and Attorney General Tim Griffin keep saying, where they sort of act like the problem in Arkansas, if you buy their argument, is that there is a small group of criminals that commit basically all of the crimes, And the problem is that they get to prison and then they're released right away and they go out and they commit more crimes. And if we could just keep those bad guys locked up altogether, then all the crime would be gone.
Yeah.
And it's that's not really borne out by any sort of data or logic. I mean, Clark Tucker, state senator, pointed out, you know, we already lock up. We're in the top 5 percentage-wise as far as percentage of our population that is incarcerated. We're first in time served for a number of, like, violent and drug crimes among all states. Just in terms of, like, the average amount of time that a person convicted for one of these crimes serves, we lead everybody in a lot of these. And as Senator Tucker pointed out, if locking people up longer made us safer, then we should already be safe.
Like, yeah, you would think we would be at the top or, like, you know, as far as, like, public safety.
And you almost, I mean, it's almost, I mean, it is ridiculous, but it's almost ironic to sit here, you know, knowing we lock up this many people already for as long as we do. It's like we have the incarceration dial kind of turned to 9, and we're still pointing, like, well, we haven't fixed any of these under, like, we haven't fixed the public safety issue. There's all this crime happening. I know. We bump it to 10.
Right.
Like, we have no data to suggest that what we've done so far works, so let's just do it a little harder, maybe now.
Yeah, it's funny, like, how, I mean, quickly this has changed. I mean, funny, it's darkly funny, I guess, that I feel like there was like this sort of growing consensus, even on among some conservatives, like 8 or 9 years ago or so, or maybe less, that like something was kind of broken about the way that we were incarcerating people in this country. And that, I mean, the, you know, the U.S. was locking up just a huge percentage of people compared to other comparable countries, and that there needed to be reforms, I mean, of some kind. And a lot of states, you know, began making reforms just to try to not send people to prison for, I mean, such crazy long periods. And now there's a wave of states doing exactly the opposite. Arkansas is not the only place that's doing this kind of thing. Though it seems like the governor has been like eager to make this like a signature issue of hers. She campaigned on it. She's like, and it sounds good, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's political red meat. You know, Arkansas does have slightly higher than average rates of certain crimes.
Yeah.
And it's very, and, you know, it's the salacious ones. It's, you know, we have a higher murder rate. We have, you know, higher drug conviction rates and stuff. And it's almost like people know that our rates are a little higher. And it's very easy for a politician, and they've done it forever, just not, I guess, quite as loud and comprehensively, but to get out there and just say, like, you know, crime is a problem and we need to lock up criminals. It sounds great. It doesn't fix anything, and they've never shown an ability to do it in an effective way. But until, I guess, the voting public as a whole gets beyond buying into simple sound bites, it's a great one. Like, it's right up there with, you know, anti-abortion messaging and stuff. So you don't have to have any sort of plan beyond do X, and half the populace is like, yeah, sure, that sounds great.
The other reason why there has been some interest in criminal justice reform from conservative quarters is the sheer cost of it. And I mean, prisons are really expensive to run and maintain. The thing that you get into in your story is how, I mean, states appropriating all this new money to build a new prison. You know, that's down the road, that they're going to build this massive new institution. But in the short term, they face this crisis around staffing.
Yeah, that's the other part that, I mean, we working on the story, we tried to get somebody from the governor's office or the attorney general's office to sort of chime in and explain this part, because it doesn't make sense. But, you know, they're wanting to add more prisoners to existing prisons at the same time that system-wide they're 42% of those frontline, like, prison guards and corporals, which is, you know, you become a corporal after about 6 months of employment there. 42% of those opening, or of those positions, are vacant and have been for a long time. And so in the PROTECT Act, they bumped up the salaries between $8,000 and $12,000 for every tier of ADC employee, but there doesn't seem to be any sort of corresponding hiring increase that comes with these new salaries. Because even with the raise, you're talking starting pay just a little north of $40,000, which, you know, is higher than, I guess, the median income for Arkansas. But at the same time, you're telling this person, okay, here's what you're going to do, is you're going to go in and be a prison guard in a prison way out in the middle of nowhere. So enjoy your commute, or you're going to, or live out, you know, in Grady or Gould or something, you know, somewhere in there.
Because by definition, most of these places are, like, located away from major populations.
Right. Cities. So you're going to be out in the middle of nowhere. You're going to give you $40,000. The prisons are very understaffed. So unless we're hiring a ton of people at the same time you start, you're going into a spot knowing you're going to be doing more than just the job that you would normally do.
Right.
And, like, it's not safe for either group. You know, it's not safe for prisoners when it's that understaffed because of violence against one another. Yeah. It's not safe for guards because in a lot of ways it's like, you know, a daycare. You've got a ratio of, like, you can only have – you're going to be responsible for so many people as one guard before it just becomes impossible.
Yeah.
And, like, that's the goal. There should be, like, you know, I don't know what the exact number is, but they're way beyond that now. Like, their guards are responsible for, like, 3 and 4 times as many prisoners as they should be.
And I think you had a detail in here about how you go beyond those frontline sort of bottom tier positions. And, I mean, unsurprisingly, if you're paid more and are kind of less in the line of, like, you know, yeah, immediate danger, those positions are more, are, like, filled up better, right?
Yeah, it's a weird pay structure. I mean, it's sort of an exponentially growing kind of curve as you look at it. You know, when they were given these raises, the corporal position bumped up from a little over 32 to a little over 40. The major positions at the top of the pay scale got a $12,000 raise. Like, they started at a much higher number and got a bigger raise percentage-wise. There's no vacancies in those. There's only a handful of vacancies, even in, like, the sergeant rank right above corporal.
Yeah.
So everything that isn't sort of a frontline, hands-on, dealing with inmate positions pays pretty well, and there's not a whole lot of turnover, and there's a ton of bureaucracy. There's a lot of those spots, and those people are happy.
The whole thing reminds me of just, like, larger labor market issues around, like, everything from childcare workers to people that work in, you know, elder care, nursing homes or whatever, food service. Like, it's a tight labor market, and it's easier for people to, like, find a better job, you know, which is good for workers, but it also means it's just, like, harder to fill these, like, pretty shitty positions where you're putting people into dangerous situations.
Yeah, and, I mean, these are, like, certified law enforcement positions. You go, you get hired, you go train down in Camden, mm-hmm. like law enforcement officers do. So if you're somebody who's even considering it, I mean, even if you're not talking about the very rural prisons out in the middle of nowhere, like, there's the one, there's a unit in Benton, just for example. If you go to work there, you're starting at about 41,000. If you just get a job at the Benton PD, you're starting a little over 60.
Yeah.
In the same town, and the Benton PD job is objectively easier and safer and has more resources, and you're infinitely less likely to just get injured on the job.
Yeah.
Like, why would anybody pick the other one?
So another thing about the PROTECT Act, I mean, you talked to Jeff Rosenzweig, I believe, who's a, you know, defense attorney who takes on a lot of capital cases and is kind of known around Arkansas for taking on cases nobody else will oftentimes. And he talked about how the real population crunch is not going to be, you know, next year, but in, like, further down the road as you're rolling back these parole rules.
Yeah, and in a lot of ways, it's another parallel to Learns, where, you know, people pointed out that the whole thing's kind of backloaded, where, like, the real cost and the real pressure to the system is a little ways down the road. Whether that's so certain people can be off doing new jobs by then and it doesn't blow back on them, who knows?
Yeah.
But, yeah, Jeff's point was, you know, in 5-6 years, when some people who've been convicted in, say, the last year would have normally been eligible for parole and possibly be getting out, and now they're not because they're having to serve 85 or 100% of their sentence, like, all of a sudden that starts backing up. So, you know, the next year when you've got another group of them that should have been released and they're still in there.
Yeah.
Now you've got 2 years worth of people who would have been paroled that are still in, and we're still adding people at an alarming rate. One weird detail in the PROTECT Act was they took fleeing and turned it into a felony. Basically, it's written so that if you take off in a car and, and flee from police, that becomes a felony now. So now all of a sudden you're looking at actual prison time and not the misdemeanor that fleeing was before. So, like, they found new ways to add even more crimes to the people who are going to prison, tell them we're not going to let them out as soon as we were, and at the same time not doing anything to adjust the capacity or the ability to supervise them.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think Jeff's exactly right. This becomes, say, like, year 5 to year 10, even looking at the few cost projections they gave for this, that's when the costs get bad. That's when the numbers jump. By the end of, I want to say, like, year 8 or so, they expected another 1,500 prisoners on top of what normally would have been, like, the projected growth anyway, another 1,500 on top of that.
That's on top of the growth, which it has been growing already.
Yeah, we're, like, back above COVID levels already. We're above capacity for what should technically be held in our prisons as it is. We're more than 1,000 above that. And now you're talking about add another 1,500 plus whatever the normal growth would have been, and the prison they've set aside money for, is still apparently just in the planning stages. They haven't even settled on a precise location. There's no building, so that's years off. I don't know what their plan is in the interim.
For years and years now, the state has been sort of warehousing people in county jails. There's all of these backup inmates in county jails that are just kind of, it almost serves as like an extra, you know, prison unit, sort of spread out across the jails in the state. And that's caused all sorts of consternation and like weird incentives too at the county level. In the short term, I mean, this is like what started this whole sort of made all this public was the governor and her corrections secretary at the time, Joe Porfiri, you know, had some plan to add some number of new beds.
To a handful of existing prisons, especially, but it came to a head with the one up in Newport.
Okay.
That's the one where the board was like, there's just literally no way. There's not enough staffing. There is not room. You can't do it. And that's when Porfiri was asking, like, what if we put in some tents? Could people live in tents out in the courtyard there?
Yeah.
And yeah, so that's really when that's when they dug in and everything started kind of bubbling up.
And that's when, you know, we get into this. I mean, you can go to read the article for the sort of detailed blow by blow here of how it all played out. But like, get into this weird constitutional issue about who is really in charge of the prison system. Is it the governor or is it this independent Board of Corrections?
Yeah, and they even tried to change that, I mean, in the Protect Act, shuffling around, you know, Porfiri, the secretary would have normally been under the board, has always been under the board. The Department of Correction and the Department of Community Corrections are both supposed to be under the secretary. Protect Act and a different act worked together to move all of them nominally under the governor now, which creates this whole other constitutional issue that we get into in there.
Yeah, because there's this constitutional amendment that goes back to the 40s that says that the board is independent. Is that right?
And they get to have that day-to-day hiring and firing ability and supervisory ability over people like the secretary, and the governor doesn't want that.
So I can't remember where things stood the last time we talked about this on the podcast, but you know, there's been some changes in like I don't want to get into all of the all the back and forth about what happened between the board and the governor, but for a little while there we weren't quite sure whether the Attorney General was going to appeal this to the state Supreme Court, but now he has.
Yeah, right? he's appealed both of the circuit court decisions. In the one out of Judge Fox's court, which was the Freedom of Information Act lawsuit that Tim Griffin brought in his professional capacity against the board. Judge Fox dismissed that because Griffin basically refused to do what the court said and help the board have legal representation. He wouldn't sign off on the attorney they had hired. He wouldn't help them find somebody else. Judge Fox said, I warned you, dismissed it. He's appealed.
And then the other one, though, is the one that really goes to that constitutional amendment.
So that's one out of Patty James Court. And she entered an injunction saying that these changes to that structure, you know, who's in charge of the secretary, all that, that was likely unconstitutional. So she issued an injunction on that pending that result. And so the Attorney General has filed a notice of appeal on that, but hasn't done anything on that appeal yet. They haven't lodged the record or filed anything. In the other one, they filed some motions. They're trying to get the same attorney for the board disqualified by the Supreme Court since it didn't work at the circuit court level. So it's still a procedural mess. The state is very eager to not have to get into the merits of this and litigate it on the merits. They're really trying to win by any procedural move they can on both of these cases for some reason.
Meanwhile, this whole thing is just like it's such a mess all the way around. Like I've been reporting some on like this Board of Corrections member, Alonzo Giles, who is like, it's kind of this whole separate thing, but he is one of the people on the Board of Corrections, which is a 7-member board, who's been kind of standing in the way of the governor. But he is now a defendant in the series of civil lawsuits that allege like these terrible acts of child abuse that occurred at this behavioral health facility where he was an administrator for decades. And he's been facing calls from lawmakers and others, the governor as well, to resign, though that's also complicated because the governor's like own sort of personal family involvement with the same institution where these alleged acts of abuse took place. That was ran by a guy, Ted Sewell, who was like a close associate of her father, Mike Huckabee. So the governor's sort of rhetoric on that has been like sort of noticeably restrained. And she's been like, Alonzo Giles should step down, but you know, like very much lacks the kind of like passionate, you know, like the venom that you come to expect from Sarah Sanders.
And I mean, that's in the same sort of vein as trying to get the board's attorney disqualified. You know, it's not like the Giles allegations are new. Mm-hmm. You know, that suit's been out there for months. Nobody said anything when Alonzo Giles wasn't voting with the board in a way that Sarah didn't like. Mm. And then at some point, you know, end of the year, first of the year, he did something that I guess irritated her. And all of a sudden, just lo and behold, all these legislators like had this epiphany of like, oh my goodness, do you know about these allegations? Right. How why won't he step down? And Giles' response was basically like, I deny that those allegations are real. I'm going to get my day in court. And surprisingly, if you haven't paid attention to how much Benny Magnus, the chair of the Board of Corrections, and the governor have been butting heads, the chair of the Board of Corrections was like, yeah, if he gets his day in court, you know, if he loses in court, then we'll deal with that then. If not, then he's staying on the board, and there's nothing the governor can do about it.
Yeah.
A lot of just middle fingers back and forth on stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah. Even today, I was listening to a legislative hearing about something else, and I happened to catch that they're referring a, like, something involving the hiring of that outside attorney to a legislative audit, to another legislative committee that does reviews, you know. So it's just, I mean, this is consuming a great deal of time and energy at the highest levels of state government.
And consuming it with stuff that's sort of tangential to any issues that matter. Like all of this whining over like who's in charge of the board, like it only became an issue because the person she put in charge, the governor put in charge of the board, was just objectively bad at what he was doing. To the point where, like, the board was, like, asking him, like, so what's your plan for, you know, this prison? And his response would be something along the lines of, well, I'll let you know if I need to.
So do we know what is Joe Porfiri doing now? What is...
He's getting paid a little over, or about $200,000 a year to be the governor's senior advisor on corrections issues. Uh-huh. I haven't seen or heard anything that he's done since he got fired.
Yeah, and there's a new... Is it an interim secretary?
No, I think she finally, well, I don't know if she's been approved by the board, but they've indicated that they're going to.
Okay.
Former chief of staff for the Department of Corrections.
Yeah. So there's, I mean, in other words, like there is a new person in charge at the Corrections Department.
Yeah, it's insane that Joe Porfiri is getting paid $200,000 a year to exist near the governor, occasionally talk about prisons. I don't know.
Yeah. I haven't heard him make any kind of public.
No, I've reached out to a couple different people just trying to say, like, well, you know, what's his job description? What are his job duties? Yeah. And the response I always get back is basically, he's advising the governor on corrections issues.
You can read Matt's story in the current edition of the Arkansas Times on newsstands now. Finally today, endorsements.
Okay, I'm just going to lean into this and give my endorsement for The Women by Kristen Hannah. It is pretty cheesy. It's about a Vietnam nurse. There's lots of romance. There's lots of drama. It's a little overwrought at times, but it's kind of like a beach read, and I'm ready for that.
So I'd like to endorse an obit, which is a little bit grim maybe, but it's a really beautiful piece of writing commemorating an amazing person, Bill Whitworth, a former editor of The Atlantic. He was also a senior editor of The New Yorker for many years, and he died just last week in Conway. The list of accomplishments really is too long here to go into, but if you go to the Arkansas Times website, you can read the obituary from Ernie Dumas about William Whitworth. He was a friend of Charles Portis, worked at the Arkansas Gazette, eventually followed Portis to New York to work at the Herald Tribune, and then on to work at the peak of magazine publishing. And after you read Ernie's obit of Bill Whitworth, also check out a piece that we republished from the Oxford American by former Oxford American editor Maxwell George, who got to know Bill a bit a few years back. And that goes into further detail about Bill's friendship with jazz trumpeter Dizzy Gillespie. And Bill was also a trumpeter himself and considered pursuing a career in music before eventually going into publishing. And Max goes into some pretty fascinating stuff about their friendship, which was kicked off after a jazz show in St. Louis. Both of those two fantastic pieces of writing and really beautiful commemorations of the life of a extraordinary person who I wish that I had gotten to know, but did not. Check them out.
And I would like to endorse the next film in the Arkansas Times film screening lineup, which takes place on the third Tuesday at the Riverdale 10 VIP Cinema. So this Tuesday, the 19th, we are screening Kundun, which is a film by Martin Scorsese that came out in between Casino and Bringing Out the Dead. And it's about the life of the 14th Dalai Lama, essentially from the time that he was discovered to be the reincarnation of a previous Dalai Lama until the time that he leaves Tibet. This month will mark the 65th anniversary of his fleeing and exile. The film was produced by Disney, and it's kind of hard to see because it's not streaming on anywhere, essentially because Disney often bows to business pressures from China. It was notoriously released in Christmas of 1997 in only two theaters. So that's Tuesday, March 19th at 7 p.m. at the Riverdale 10 VIP Cinema. I hope to see you there. And that's the show. Thanks for listening to the Arts and Times Week in Review podcast. We'll see you next week.